Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is KUCI, and we broadcast worldwide on the internet at www.kuci.org as well. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors talking about the art and business of writing. And as a thank you for listening, I have begun to do ticket giveaways, as some of you already know. Last week I did this over email, and Susan Perry, Elizabeth Defner, and Carrie Schreiner won tickets to see Paula Poundstone at the Sun Theater. Carol Locknett won tickets to see Steve Earle at the Sun tonight. So just before the break, I will tell you about the tickets I have to give away this week. Now, on with the show. Today I have two guests, Amy Liu and Tom Paine. My first guest is Amy Liu, the author of Cloud Mountain, published by Warner Books. This novel is based on the true story of Liu's American grandmother and Chinese revolutionary grandfather, their marriage in the early 1900s in America, and their life together and apart during the First Chinese Republic, the warlord era, and the Japanese invasion of China. Cloud Mountain was serialized in Good Housekeeping magazine, and was published in German, Dutch, French, Italian, Swedish, Norwegian, Finnish, Spanish, South American, and United Kingdom editions. Liu's first novel, Face, published in 1994 by Warner Books, centers on a young photographer who exposes three generations of family secrets dating back to Imperial China, while coming to terms with her mixed-race identity and her own hidden past. Liu published a highly acclaimed account of anorexia nervosa called Solitaire, in 1979 by Harper & Row. At the age of 25, she worked as a fashion model and flight attendant, edited business and trade publications, and was an associate producer for NBC's Today Show before turning to writing full-time. She has co-authored seven nonfiction books and written numerous articles on medical and psychological topics. She has been a guest speaker at Yale University, UCLA, and writers' conferences throughout the country. She lives in Los Angeles with her husband and son. Welcome, Amy.
Yes, hi.
Hi. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
Cloud Mountain is a novel based on a true story, and I'm curious what moved you to write this book.
I was working on writing this book for about 15 years before I actually pulled it together to do it. The story of my grandparents always was sitting there as sort of like a tray of candy, just waiting for me to pick up and do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really just a matter of my growing into my writing ability, actually, to pull it off, because I knew it was a very big story. It was a large undertaking. And I wrote my first novel, which was published in 89, as kind of a way to prove to myself that I could write a novel and to warm up to the much larger task of writing Cloud Mountain. And so I think it was really once I'd gotten the first novel under my belt, I had enough nerve to tackle the job. But the story of my grandmother being a white Caucasian American woman at the turn of the century marrying a Chinese scholar revolutionary and violating the laws of California and all the laws of the West to do it, and then going back to China during the warlord era and the New Republic and getting all caught up in all of that was obviously a very dramatic story to work with. And so that was the motivation.
Interesting. Now, your BA is in art.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find your way to writing?
I kind of got sidetracked into art when I was in college. I was always headed for literature and writing, and I really just got seduced into the world of the art department. I went to Yale, and they have an amazing art department, and it's a very different culture from the rest of the university, and I was just drawn into it. And I don't regret it, but, you know, because I think the visual experience certainly informs my work and is helpful, but it was basically a detour.
Well, your book, because it's a novel based on a true story, how did you know when to stray from the truth and fictionalize?
Essentially, it was very, that part of it was very easy because I didn't have a whole lot to work with. I had the bare bones of the story, and over the course of 15 years, I interviewed my father and his sister, who were really the only surviving members of the family who had strong memories of their life growing up in China. And I unearthed a number of things that were very helpful, including a book of my grandfather's memoirs, which I found at the UCLA Research Library. But it was written in classical Chinese, and so I had to get it translated into English. And there were a few boons like that. But basically, I had the bare bones of the story and a few anecdotes that were wonderful but very, very sketchy. And then I had to kind of fill in around that. And so everything that I filled in was out of necessity. It was fiction.
Interesting.
But my objective in really writing the book was, I feel that my life is pretty boring, certainly by comparison with my grandmother's. And I actually was quite envious of her life, and I really wanted to walk around in her shoes and experience what she'd experienced and maybe try and undo a little bit of the bitterness that she had ended her life with and reconceptualize how she might have lived this experience so that it was a more positive episode rather than what it ended up in real life for her, which was something that was much more conflicted than it is in the book. But
did you find out anything that you just absolutely had no idea about?
Oh, lots of everything, basically everything in the book. I grew up knowing only that I had a Chinese grandfather that was married to my American grandmother, and she had come back to this country after having four children with him and living for 20 years in China and raising her family in China, and then basically never saw him again. And that was all I knew. So everything that I found out in the course of writing this book was new, and probably the most important thing that I discovered, which was years after I started digging up stuff, my father just threw out one day the fact that his father, when the communists were poised to come into to take over China, he had written a letter back to the family asking them to take him back, to bring him back to America so that he could essentially escape China and be reunited with the family. And she turned him down. And so I've adjusted that a little bit for the dates, and I found another letter that was dated 1939, which was 10 years earlier, which hinted at the same thing. And so that was really the starting point of my book. The book opens with the character that's based on my grandmother receiving a letter from her husband asking to be reunited with the family. And then the whole book is basically her reliving her life, trying to figure out what the answer is that she has to give this man. And then hopefully by the end of the book you understand her reply. But it took me the whole process of writing this book to understand how she could have replied in the way that she did.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of different reasons for it, but that was certainly an important bit.
Will you read to us?
Sure.
And I'd like to say this is KUCI 88.9 FM, and you're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Amy Liu, and she's about to read from Cloud Mountain.
Okay. So let me set this up a little bit. This is a passage that's quite late in the book, and it's throughout the book I have Hope, who's the main character, writing letters and writing in her journal. And this is a segment from her journal, which is dated March 1st, 1917, and it describes what warlord China is like from her point of view, and also what her life and her marriage are like. She's now, they've been married for 11 years at the time of this entry, and she's been back in China for 5 years. I should say she's been in China for 5 years with her husband, and so it's all starting to sink in with her.
Mm-hmm.
All right, she writes, "War is everywhere now. The rivers and creeks are swollen with the dead. The alleys with the homeless and maimed, Across China as across Europe, thousands lie pruned of their limbs and heads or shot through the eyes and hearts. Girls and mothers are raped and gored by rampaging soldiers. Tattered bodies fall spread-eagled, the sepia shreddings of wives' photographs, letters from lovers, identification cards strewn like petals across lifeless faces. I have gone out into the countryside to see them, but they have also come to me. In the harbor, floating fields of pink, white, and red paper funeral flowers bob among gray-skinned corpses of soldiers and peasants washed downstream. Meanwhile, in Peking, Paul attends victory banquets for the fast-footed bureaucrats and nobles who pledge their undying support until the next conquering a battalion swarms across the horizon and the allegiances switch again. Paul is her husband. There are times when I think I would have made a better man than woman. Like Paul, like my father, I would take my refuge in the world, in the uniform of war and motion and impersonal ideals. I would work outside myself instead of forever burrowing inward. I would be permitted, by virtue of my sex, the luxury of courting death. However, I am not my father or my husband or any of my brave, truant, voyaging friends. I may go out under escort, and I may take my notes and pictures, talk to the combatants, but the leash does not stretch far. I am tied to my children, and willingly so, but oh, the restlessness. Dad's passing cut the last cord, and now I am spinning in my moorings with nowhere to go and yet still straining for what I dare not say. As the bodies pile up around us, Paul and I live on in increasingly separate worlds, preoccupied with losses that never intersect, with ambitions that stink of secrecy. Even our bodies have become strangers to each other, insensible to the months apart. This is not the life I swore to live or the love I vowed to keep, yet I am as much to blame or more than Paul or any whiff of fate. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and you just heard my guest, Amy Liu, read from Cloud Mountain. Amy, what is the challenge of melding fiction into nonfiction?
I think one of the big challenges is to avoid the kind of cardboard cutout view of history that we tend to have when we look at old pictures, when we go back and we talk about the past. We tend to kind of look at it like a cartoon almost. It doesn't seem real. And I find very often that people don't really identify with, for example, people who lived at the turn of the century as being real, living, breathing people. And one of the great benefits that I had in writing the book is the fact that my father's a pack rat. He doesn't really talk about the past at all, but he keeps absolutely everything. And in the course of putting together the research for this book, he brought out lots of wonderful photographs, including one which is described in detail in the book, of the wedding party that my grandparents participated in when they went to get married. It was, as I said, it was against the law for them to get married in California at the turn of the century, or anywhere in the West. On the West Coast, they were living in San Francisco, so they had to travel by train for 3 days to get to Wyoming. That was the first closest state where they would be allowed to marry, where a Chinese man would be allowed to marry a white woman. And so they went immediately after the San Francisco earthquake, when the city was preoccupied and people weren't as interested in looking over their shoulder at, you know, who was fraternizing with who. They and about three or four other couples got together, and they rode the train together to Wyoming to get married. And on the way, they had a photograph taken of all of them, and it was a joke photograph where they traded hats. The men were wearing the women's hats, and the women were wearing the men's hats. And my father talked to me about this photograph for years before he actually finally found it in the rabbit's warren that is his office. And he came out with it, and I just couldn't believe it, because the people, they all had these kind of comical expressions. Obviously, they had to pose for a long time in those days for pictures. You had to sit for about a minute before the thing took. So a great deal of thought had gone into this picture, and they were funny faces, and they were wearing these hats. And it was just such a human image, and you could see the personalities of all of these different people in the picture. And that was kind of one of my objectives in fictionalizing this story, was to take it from a cardboard cutout to something that had as much life as this photograph did.
Mm. Why did you choose to fictionalize it rather than writing their story as it was?
Mostly because I didn't have enough material, mm-hmm. and I didn't think that I could dig up enough material. There weren't enough people left who really remembered in depth who I could interview.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, I think that you're always one step or several steps removed when you're writing nonfiction. It's really hard to get under the skins of the characters as you can in fiction. So for my purposes, it was the only way to go.
Interesting. Well, you've written both fiction and nonfiction, and am I correct to assume that you prefer fiction? And if so, why?
Oh, I do. Well, the kind of nonfiction that I was writing sort of pop psychology and business books, self-help books, that kind of thing, which is a very particular stripe of nonfiction, and it's fine. For me, it's like putting together a puzzle, and you get the broad strokes of the puzzle in, and then it's just a matter of filling in the details, and it's fun to devise the puzzle initially. It's not so much fun to follow through and finish it off. It's kind of like coloring by numbers.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of other kinds of nonfiction that I think are just as luscious as fiction. I haven't quite gotten into working with those modes. But I think that fiction is, obviously, it's a much more personal art form. It's much harder, I find. It's incredibly harder. But there's artistry to it, and you do have that satisfaction, that big aha when you either see into a character's soul and they talk back and surprise you, or you're able to write a turn of phrase that just really makes your fingers tingle. I mean, it's just more exciting.
What makes fiction harder, do you think?
I think it's that process of breathing life into the page.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult, and just recreating life doesn't do it. You know, it's funny. You can't just sit down at the computer and just write what your life was today.
Mm.
And very usually that doesn't come alive at all. It's got to be taken to another level, which is somewhere beyond. It's like floating above life a little bit, and you're constantly reaching to get to that level. And usually you can feel when you get there, but it's like being in a very particular zone. It's like being in a very intense dream, and the challenge of writing fiction is getting into that dream and then getting it down on the page.
And keeping it going.
And keeping it going.
Well, this book, my goodness, Cloud Mountain is a big book. And the copy I have is 658 pages. And I'm very, very interested in how you kept it going. How did you keep the flow? How did you arrange working on this to have such a big book work?
Well, there is a benefit to working on something where you've got a true story that underlines it. And so I, from the stories that my father and my aunt had told me, I knew what the major scenes were and the major movement of this book was. And I tend to outline over and over and over again as I work on a book. The outline is very fluid and it's very changeable, but I always kind of have it up on the wall as a reminder if I lose track of where I'm going. So I had the basic scenes up on the wall, and I really just moved through the process of the story based on that. It was much easier than the first book that I wrote, and it was much easier than the book that I'm working on now, which are total fiction, where it's really anything goes, and it's much more difficult to keep that outline there. Mm. The other thing that kept me going in this book, which which really is, I think, the trick to keeping yourself hooked whenever you're writing fiction is there was a very strong abiding question in this book, and that quite simply was, as my mother always used to say about my grandmother, how could she? Mm-hmm. How could she have married this man when she did? And how could she have stayed with him? And how could she have turned him down when he asked to rejoin it? So it's, you know, trying to come up with answers to that very simple, very clear question on every page kept me through. And also the fact that I never totally answered it, mm-hmm. you know. It's a very open-ended, I think a lot of people come to the end of this book and they're not sure. And mm-hmm. I think that's the mark of a good book. If you come to the end and you can look at the abiding question and answer it in a variety of ways, or see a lot of different ways, that's one of the things that makes it true to life.
Yes. Geez, you're listening to 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, California. This is Writers on Writing, and my guest is Amy Liu, author of Cloud Mountain. Point of view is one of those skills that's particularly difficult for new writers, and sometimes not so new writers. Mm-hmm. And Hope's point of view in Cloud Mountain is very strong. What keeps you locked into point of view?
Well, it's interesting. In this book, in the beginning of the book, there are actually two points of view. Paul's point of view, her husband's point of view, is fairly strong in the beginning. And I think that I would have liked to have kept his point of view as strong all the way through. Mm-hmm. But one of the ideas that I was working with in this book was her attempt to get close to him, her attempt to understand what made him tick, her attempt to identify with him and bond with him, and in that very Western sense of a marriage, to make a single whole out of the two of them, which is very different from the Chinese point of view of marriage, which is, you know, that men and women are extremely separate and have separate lives, and they come together basically in the bedroom, but that their lives do not merge in the same way that our Western sense of love has them merging. As a consequence, in the early stages of the book, when Hope thinks that she knows Paul, and when they're living in America, and when he's trying to be more Western in his ways and thinking, I have his point of view stronger because it's basically filtering through her. And then as they get to China and they start to grow apart, his point of view fades away, and it's much more her speculating about what he's doing and about her trying to ground herself in her own life and understand what makes China tick and where her place is in China. So the point of view issue was actually a big hurdle in this book for me to figure out all of that and how I could justify having his point of view in one part of the book and then kind of losing it in the latter part. I felt that I needed to have the book told from Hope's point of view because, quite honestly, I didn't feel comfortable getting in the head of a Chinese man, even though he is my grandfather. I never knew him. I didn't grow up in a Chinese culture, and I just felt too uncomfortable trying to pull that off.
Mm-hmm. Well, gee, Amy, we're at the end of our time, and we could go on, and you're off to teach a class at UCLA?
Right.
So I'd love you to come back on sometime.
I would love
care
to.
And continued good luck on Cloud Mountain.
Oh, thank you so much, Barbara.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Amy Liu, author of Cloud Mountain, a very impressive work. Before we take a break, I told you I was going to tell you about tickets I have to give away. I have three pairs of tickets for Paula Cole and Jill Sobule at Coach House on Sunday the 6th. That's this coming Sunday. Three pairs, and three pair for the band Cracker at the House of Blues on Tuesday the 8th. The first three people who email me at writersonwriting at AOL.com will win them. There's three pair for each. So if you're interested, email writersonwriting@AOL.com. We're going to take a short break and return with author Tom Payne, who was with me last week, and he's back for part two of our interview. So please stay tuned. Welcome back to Writers on Writing, 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, California, and on the internet at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my next guest is Tom Payne. He was with us last week, and we're going to do part two of our interview. And he's author of Scar Vegas and Other Stories, published by Harcourt. His short stories have been published in The New Yorker, Harper's, Playboy, Zoetrope, and Story, and anthologized in the O. Henry Awards Pride Stories 1996, and the 1997 and 1998 Pushcart Prize, and elsewhere. He was recently named Writer on the Verge by The Village Voice. He teaches writing at Middlebury College in Vermont. Welcome back, Tom.
Oh, thank you, Barbara.
Great to have you again.
Thanks. Good to be back.
It's interesting. I don't think I've ever quite done an interview like this, and I like it because in the days since our last interview, I listened to the tape, and so have questions from questions I asked you last week.
Oh, great.
And one of them is we had talked about The New Yorker and how it's a difficult market to crack and how you had a story published by them on the same day that you had a rejection by them.
Right.
Now tell me more.
Well, as I sort of hinted to you, I suppose I was doing what a completely honest soul wouldn't have done, which is that I got so bored and was fairly sure through 10 years of sending out stories that no one was ever going to take my story that I sort of fudged the rule that you're only supposed to send out one copy of your story, because
mm-hmm.
I figured I've never had one published and all that, and that doesn't cover all the, whether it's right or wrong issue, but in any event, I would send out 15 or 20 copies of a story after a while to 15 or 20 places, you know, five the best places, The New Yorker and Esquire mm-hmm. and so forth, and then down the line, so to speak, and so as I said, on the day that I got, at least I got a letter of interest, I also got a form letter of rejection from them. But I should say that the letter that came back that was a semi letter of interest or acceptance came about because I put I found a name of an editor there who's a poet there, Deb Garrison, and she's still a editor there. I just put her name on it and it got to her and she dropped on the fiction editor's desk. So I think it was putting the name on it that at least got it read by someone different than the regular slush readers.
Now, did they know that they rejected your story as well?
Oh, I doubt it. I mean, they get 20,000, I believe, 20,000 or more submissions a year, and so I think they just have a constant conveyor belt of incoming, put the slip in it, outgoing.
Yeah.
Different. They have different levels of, as I understand it, of course, I've only had one story published there, that one, and I've sort of been out of touch with them, but that's what I was told at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because writers do tend to talk about this, you know. They tend to wonder how the Iron Curtain, as they called it, seemed like then.
That's right.
Worked.
Now, Scar Vegas and Other Stories, because it's so difficult selling collections of stories, I assume, first of all, that most of the stories in the book, if not all, were published elsewhere.
All but one.
And secondly, did an agent sell the book for you?
Yes, definitely. In fact, I had two agents preceding my present agent, so I don't believe it would have sold. I came to an understanding of how important an agent is after the fact. I mean, after he sold it, it began to dawn on me, quite talking to other writers, quite how important it is to have an agent. It seems, unless you're basically, you have to know an editor, I think, to get an editor to read it or be, straight. Like I send my book to Scribner's and an editor there might read it. That doesn't happen anymore. Editors are too busy. So they rely on agents to sort of screen the world. And they go to lunch with them. My impression is it's a pretty small group of people, smaller than your average high school in a very, very small town in Illinois, that decides your fate at the various houses.
Yes.
And then you get an agent. And that seems to be almost as hard as getting published, because an agent won't really take you on unless they're fairly sure that they can sell you.
Yes. True, because that's how they make their money.
Exactly.
You don't want an agent that you have to pay up front.
Right, and they too are so busy.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my agent. I don't know if I would have got an agent except, I might have, but it would have taken a lot longer, except that a writer friend of mine said you have to meet my agent.
Yes.
Because I was agentless.
Well, I found that the world of writing or the business of writing is not a whole lot different from the world of business. In that relationships are important and networking and all that. And so often introductions are the best way.
Yeah. In fact, my brother's a businessman, and I was, as I described to you last week, writing for 10 years on my own in a closet almost without really any success. And he said, Tom, the family's gotten sick of hearing you call yourself a writer. Why don't you go to STEM? He said, there must be some conference out there. where people, I mean, he's like, he was in shoes, and he said, shoe people get together in Vegas. Where do your people get together? So he actually did the research and came up with Breadloaf, uh-huh. The writer's conference up at Middlebury.
Uh-huh. Which I hear is a wonderful, wonderful one.
Yeah, it's a fabulous place. I've been going there for like 8 years now.
Uh-huh.
And it was when I got there that I realized, hey, these people are like me. Because if you're an isolated writer, you have to sort of imagine the writer's life. If you know no other writers, if you don't quite know, if you love books but you don't know that one can be a writer, that there's no assurance that you could be a writer. You're doing it in isolation and you're not getting any feedback from editors. So you're living in this sort of world where you're imagining the possibility of you being a writer, but it's an easily deflated world. And so I'm moving away from that sound.
And so
it really
semi.
Helped me when I got up there on the mountain and realized, my God, these other 200 people are have the same genetic, if it is genetic, background. They're writers. My God, I am one too. No wonder I felt so odd my whole life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I mean, not to be corny about it, but it was sort of a revelation to me that all my complexion of interests and talents were similar to these people. It was quite a relief, actually.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is Tom Paine, author of Scar Vegas and Other Stories. You're a teacher of writing.
Right.
Can you teach writing? Can you teach someone to be a writer?
Well, ironically, I think I just read this in The New Yorker this week. I think on Kenneth Tynan or someone. I believe it was him. I believe I read it there. I might have read it elsewhere. But the idea was, I think I read it somewhere else, but it doesn't matter. Someone said to someone else, that they know this writer that insisted that writing could be taught. And they said that this writer went out to try to prove that writing could be taught and was continually flummoxed. And went on to say that writer didn't quite realize that it is sort of a knack. I think that it can be taught. I have been teaching it at Middlebury and now at Warren Wilson. It can definitely be taught. But I certainly, when I teach, come across people that are writers. Those two ideas are sort of contradictory. But when I see, I mean, there may be someone who's totally untaught and they hand something in, and I'm like, I usually try and hint to them, especially if they're, well, at any age, hey, you're the real thing. This, you can't do this without having the knack, the ability. And I think it is sort of like being able to play the piano. And I think the point of the article that I read was that a lot of writers don't realize that they have a knack, and it might sound a little egotistical, from a writer to be saying, oh, I think I have the knack. I would like to think I do, but I think writers recognize it in other writers, and I'm sure some readers can recognize it in some people around them. I think it's a gift, but the basics can be taught. I certainly was taught by being a journalist for a while, you know, how to communicate and the value of a strong noun, just like Hemingway got from his journalism years, a concrete noun, and all. There's a certain level of basic stuff that you can really clean up someone's stuff, and you can teach them the basics of how to write a story. But in the end, some of it's a mystery.
Yes, it is. Well, when a beginning writer doesn't know what to write, they know they want to write, but they don't know if it's a story, a novel, an essay, a poem. How do you advise them, or how do you direct them?
Well, what I usually try to say to them, most of the people that are starting out writing, and many of them want to be writers desperately, when they put pen to paper, say I've talked to them before or after, and I've gotten to know them a bit, and usually I find them, you know, fairly interesting, if they want to be writers. And but then they put pen to paper, they hand in something that they've typed up, and it could be pretty banal. And it's nothing like their personality. It's nothing like they were just gleaming or grinning or interested in me, whatever they were saying. But it's not on the page. What I try to convey is that good writing is akin to gossip. It's the sort of thing that you tell in the middle of the night with a couple of beers in you to your ex-girlfriend or ex-best friend or your best friend. It's akin to gossip. And if you can get that voice on the page, and also whatever it is that was obsessive enough and interesting enough to you to call someone up in the middle of the night, if you can sort of put your mental or psychological or spiritual finger on that area of your life, on that gossip, on that anecdote. I'm a big one in answering your question for starting with anecdotes, something you've heard or something that piques your interest in a newspaper, for instance, and then trying to elaborate and stretch it out. And I also tell people most of the stuff I read, and I used to read for Columbia Magazine and for other magazines, and I read a lot of magazines now, is don't kid yourself. I could say it differently, but I won't. Don't kid yourself. Don't bore yourself. I mean, I meet many writers who go on and on and on, and they themselves are bored by what they're writing. Mm-hmm. And you're like, is this truly what interests you? Is this what gets you psyched? Is this what, when you put it on the page, sort of makes you laugh or tickles you makes you put your tongue in your cheek like you can't believe you're getting away with this, or the characters are getting away with that? I mean, that sort of, in some sense, it's a lot easier than some beginning writers make it out to be when they put on a suit and tie or even a tux when they sit down to work instead of kicking back and throwing off, putting on some sandals and some music. And do you know what I mean?
Yes,
I mean, afterwards
I do.
One can edit it into shape, but it has to have an energy in the beginning.
Now, you mentioned boredom, and after you approach, say, the 10th draft of a piece and you start getting bored with it, how do you know then the difference between this piece just is not happening for me, or I'm just bored because I've been at it too long, or perhaps long enough, and I should just, you know, it's finished.
Right.
I mean, how do you tell the difference between the different types of boredom?
Well, it is kind of tricky. I find that when I'm at least in my 30s, and I think it was differently when I was starting out, at least now, when I write something and I'm reaching the end of it and I've done the 10th draft or the 10th edit or more, I still, and it could just be my pleasure in writing, I still find it interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, it could be some sort of vanity about this is my own work. My God, it's close to being finished. But I still usually find my work, I find what I'm doing interesting even in the same draft. But I would say, I understand what you're asking. I think around the 10th draft, it is time to show it to your best friend or your girlfriend or boyfriend or spouse, and see if you can get them to laugh or cry. Because it is about moving. It's entertainment, which is, to be pompous, tenere, Latin, to hold, to grip the reader. And a lot of people don't realize that. So I would say show it to someone at the 10th draft. You know, you can't keep hammering your head against the wall.
Yeah, and perhaps if you are bored, maybe it's something that you have lost the energy for, and if you are really into it, maybe at the 10th draft you're still going to be.
I think so, because when I was in my 20s, I would get bored with my work, and in the end, I suspect it was because it was boring, or it wasn't particularly well done, or, as you say, something had been lost, but because I think it should still be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is actually getting interested in the craft of crafting sentences to that extreme level. I mean, you really have to be into writing to stare at your work. Unless you're really into yourself, and I don't think I am. I like the work. I like the craft of it. You know, it's sort of like doing a very fine piece of furniture, and when you're almost there and putting on the last coat of lacquer, and it's just getting really pretty, it's a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good metaphor.
You might ask how I finally felt what happened, why after 15 years I started getting published.
Okay. Let's ask you that.
Okay. I was writing all these stories, and they were getting rejected. And then I quit. I said to hell with this, and I went out in the world and became a journalist for a while. And little by little, I became much more interested in, at the time it was the city of Providence, where I was living, I became interested in the people I was meeting. They were much crazier than I felt I was. And I had been isolated trying to be a writer in my room for so long that when I got out there and had to report on these people, I became fascinated with reporting and the world around me and the politics and the intrigue and what was happening. And that plus I was pretty much a pretty strong environmentalist and pretty horrified by what I was seeing was happening to my home state and the landscape I grew up in. And finally I started building stories around that, around the exterior world, around a bit like Tom Wolfe, the living one, you know, about what's happening right now in the politics and the world around us. And when I did that, and I coupled that with, like, worrying a lot more about the reader and whether the reader was getting pleasure being into it, I was actually shocked at first and then thrilled that my first story that did get published, it made my wife cry. She wasn't my wife at the time. She was my girlfriend. And I let her read it, and she came in with her tears coming out of her eyes, and she was holding it like a turd at the end of her fingers. And I thought, oh, my God. And she was like, how can someone I love have written this? And I thought, God, is it that bad? And what's happened is every time that my wife has either burst into tears or started laughing, that story gets published.
Interesting.
Because I think I've been thinking a lot more about the larger world, but also the experience of the reader and actually having something to convey to them. So that I think that, and when I started doing that, I started getting published, because I think a lot of writers don't do that.
So what kind of stories were you writing before?
Hard to explain.
The ones that were getting rejected.
Right, right. It's very hard to explain what I was writing before. I was writing a lot of imitations, but a lot of it was just very, I mean, I was into some strange writers, like I was writing some plays even, the early plays of Sam Shepard, mm-hmm. which, you know, Sam and whoever, I think, just passed a typewriter back and across the table, and they drank a lot, and so I was writing sort of mood pieces and things that came from some deep, strange psychological place, which meant a lot to me. They seemed to convey something poetical, something deep within myself. To me, I keep saying to me because it was pretty clear after a while that no one else was getting. But these were like, these stories meant so much to me. They were like flesh chipped off me. I mean, they were so deeply me, and I could not for the life of me see why the rest of the world did not see what I felt I was saying, that it was so deeply personal. A lot of it was autobiographical stuff, and a lot of it was done with strange styles, real stream of consciousness, you know, one long sentence, and some of it was science fiction, and it was all very odd. But I felt deeply that this was communicating something very important. Maybe I was crazy, I don't know.
So it sounds like what you're saying is when you took what you were personally and emotionally involved in and interested in, which sounds like the environment and politics, and somehow melded that into fiction, that's when you started to cook.
I think so, yeah. And also when I guess something happened, some change occurred in me, I don't know what it was, but there was a general arc from internal concerns and sort of stuff that would be akin to poetry of a messier and more complex variety. Sort of an arc outward from myself. Maybe I grew up, I don't know, but I became less and less interested. Maybe I became boring to myself. I became less and less interested than what was deep inside. I also think I wrote through some sort of stuff. I don't know what exactly. I think I just, as I wrote and wrote and wrote, someone in me, the writer, sort of developed eyes to look out of myself at the world. So I think for 10 years, the writing was partly a growing up, a recapturing of this, of the writer, who had been pretty quiet for many years.
Hmm. Now, do you think MFAs are important? I'm asking because I have a student here at UCI that the other night, after class, he asked me, should I get in an MFA program or just join a writer's workshop? What should I do? And there's pros and cons of both of those things.
Yeah, the first thing that springs to mind is, it is actually the first thing that springs to mind, is money. It's really pretty expensive often, unless you go to one of the places, I think Iowa, some other places have scholarships, but my school didn't have I had some scholarship, but I still have huge college loans. I'm teaching at one now. As I said earlier, I do believe that writing up to a certain point can definitely be taught. And also part of MFA programs are sort of mutual support societies for people who, as I said earlier, also have never been around other writers and can't believe that they're writers, and the other people hopefully will help them along the path to developing, at least that happened for me in part, a confidence in what one is doing. So in that sense, it also seems to be sort of both necessary. In some sense, you can certainly get published without going to one, but it's actually a lot of fun, and you meet a lot of other writers who can, well, help you in your career later on, and you can meet agents. And I think it's worth 2 cents in terms of when you send in your book to an agent. You know, they might say, "Oh, look, this guy went to Columbia, or this woman went to Columbia." Or it might get you read before 20 other people. And I hate to say it, but a lot of it's that after a certain point. Because I think in the end, you wouldn't have to do, because I think a true writer is so obsessed with their work that they would eventually get where they're going. But on the other hand, it helped me.
Well, we have about 3 minutes left, and one question I've been wanting to ask is, when a writer's beginning, when a writer's starting out, what do you think is most important? Talent, perseverance, agility with language, storytelling ability, something else entirely?
I think the ability to lie. If you're not a good liar, forget it. Mm-hmm. And I say that semi-facetiously, but also quite seriously. If you're not the person in your family who... you can be a journalist or a nonfiction writer, but if you're not the person in the family with that sort of trickster glint in their eye who loved pulling one over on their family members just for the pure fun of it, but at the same time, the minute that person might get upset with the trick you're pulling on them, somehow through your own imagination could swing around and become the sort of priest, rabbi, counselor of the family, all in a flash. So I would say deep down, I or someone else can teach one to become a writer. You do have to have some sort of linguistic ability. But if you don't have that deep spiritual or trickster or whatever you want to call it and whatever word you want to use for it, if you don't have those two things, both a deep reason to write, a deep sort of soulful calling, like a Roman Catholic kid I was brought up to be one would say, you know, like they used to say about being a priest, if you don't have that sort of calling coupled with some sort of imagination, playfulness, your chances are lessened. Because I meet so many people who are so desperately serious about their writing, and that's fine, but I feel bad for them sometimes because they're so arch about it all. And most of the writers I've met who are on the cusp of being published or have been published, they're very funny, loose, imaginative, but usually deep, sometimes a little messed up, liars/priests. And that's who they are. And so that's a long answer to your question. I think you have to have those two things, be a liar minister, liar rabbi.
Interesting. Well, that's a great answer.
Well, thanks.
And once again, we
got it. Again, it's a real fast half hour.
It really is.
Oh, that might be because I rattle on, but I appreciate you having me on.
Well, I appreciate you rattling on, actually. I'm going to have to do this again.
God willing, I have a novel coming out.
Let me know, and we'll book it.
Okay. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That was Tom Paine, author of Scar Vegas and Other Stories, published by Harcourt. Next week, my guest will be T. Jefferson Parker, author of Red Light. If you have comments or questions, please email me through my website at writersonwriting.com or at writersonwriting@aol.com. And I'd like to leave you with a quote by Susan Sontag, and she said, "Volume depends precisely on the writers having been able to sit in a room every day, year after year, alone." This is 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, California. Thank you for listening.